All right. Hey, baby. I'm glad you're back. Still here listening to the Loose Wigs. That's the way to go, man. You got to keep a loose wig. And now we're ready for you to begin another listening session. I want to put your shoes on or take your shoes off, part your hair, and be ready now to dig another Loose Wig. Are we ready for Loose Wig 1, side 2?
Un sanatorium de la région parisienne. Nous sommes allés le voir et nous avons essayé de l'interviewer. Je dis essayer parce que Bud est un homme excessivement renfermé auquel il faut poser plusieurs fois la même question avant qu'il accepte d'y répondre. De plus, il a été techniquement difficile de réaliser cette interview, mais je pense que malgré cela, vous prendrez beaucoup d'intérêt à l'entendre. Bud, vous m'avez dit tout à l'heure que vous aviez écrit un nouveau morceau depuis votre arrivée à l'hôpital. Voulez-vous nous en donner le titre et le fredonner?
I wrote In the Mood for a Classic.
Bud, pour qui avez-vous composé ce morceau, s'il vous plaît?
I composed it for friends in general.
Bud a composé ce morceau pour tous ses amis. Bud, voulez-vous nous dire quels sont vos pianistes préférés?
Al Haig. He's my perfect pianist.
Bud dit que Al Haig représente pour lui le pianiste parfait. Bud, voulez-vous citer d'autres pianistes?
I told you Al Haig. Well, let me see. On piano, I always did like Buddy Powell. Hank Jones.
Je vous ai dit Al Haig, répond Bud. Et il ajoute, j'ai toujours aimé Billy Kyle et Hank Jones. Notons qu'à ses débuts, Bud fut fortement influencé par Billy Kyle. Bud Powell, quel est votre maître au piano?
Arte.
Bud, avez-vous fréquenté Arte Toon?
I don't know. Arte used to take me for a drive in his big Lincoln. He had a sky blue Lincoln. Yeah. I have been in his car.
Bud raconte que Arte Toon l'emmenait souvent dans sa grosse voiture bleu ciel. Quel est votre compositeur favori, Bud?
Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk. One of my friends from a long time ago. We used to hang out all day and all night. And after I was joined.
Bud, voulez-vous nous dire quels sont vos musiciens favoris en dehors des pianistes? Quel trompettiste, quel saxophoniste aimez-vous?
Saxophone John Gess. For trumpet, Miles Davis.
Et parmi les bassistes?
When he was alive, Oscar Pettiford. I like Tommy Potter, he's a good bass player.
Bud cite Miles Davis, Johnny Griffin, Sonny Rollins, Oscar Pettiford et Tommy Potter. Quels sont vos accompagnateurs favoris, Bud?
Max Roach et Ray Brown.
Bud Powell va beaucoup mieux au sanatorium. Les docteurs lui ont donné quelques jours de vacances. Il est dans notre studio ce soir et va nous donner lui-même de ses nouvelles.
I feel fine, thank you. The doctor said I'll be well soon and I'll go home. He said it's improving fast.
Je vais bien, merci. Le docteur a dit que je serai bientôt de retour. Il a dit que l'amélioration avait été rapide. Bud, avez-vous entendu des choses intéressantes récemment?
Well, Charlie Mingus is nice and Tachiko is nice. I think she's a very technical pianist.
Charlie Mingus et Toshiko, que j'aime bien. Je pense qu'elle est une excellente technicienne du piano. Bud, écoutez-vous souvent des disques de Arte Toon?
I'm crazy about Tatum. Still my best man, one of my good friends.
J'adore Arte Toon. Il demeure musicalement mon meilleur ami. Bud, quelles sont vos dernières compositions?
Three new tunes. In the Mood for a Classic is one. Hey Diddy D is another. And Noche con Francis is the other.
J'ai écrit In the Mood for Classic, et NDDD, et Un Noche con Francis. Connaissez-vous Bill Evans, Bud?
I heard him on records only. He's nice. He can play. I heard he was sick.
Je ne l'ai entendu qu'en disque. Il joue bien. On m'a dit qu'il était malade. Bud, merci d'être venu et au revoir.
Bonsoir. Je reviens bientôt.
Get out of there, Bud.
Well, that little egg that I told you about, God brings a soul into it, and it starts to grow. It grows for 9 whole months inside the mother, right under her heart. And then, when it's ready to come out, the mother goes to the hospital so the doctor can help her, and the baby slips out through the tiny opening in her body.
You mean Mommy has a hole in her body?
Sure. Now, we all have different openings in our bodies for different things. You have holes in your nose to breathe through and a mouth to stuff cookies into.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, mothers have a little opening between their legs.
The next selection is from Miguel de Unamuno, a little essay called The Religion of Quixotism. We shall find the hero of Spanish thought, not in any philosopher who lived in flesh and bone, but in an entity of fiction and of action, more real than all the philosophers, Don Quixote. The feeling that animated Don Quixote cannot strictly be called idealism. He didn't fight for ideas. It was spiritualism. He fought for spirit. Speculative or meditative Quixotism is like practical Quixotism, foolishness, a daughter foolishness to the foolishness of the cross, and therefore it is contemned by reason. Philosophy at bottom abhors Christianity. For an individual, as for a people, the highest heroism is being willing to face ridicule. Still more, being willing to make oneself ridiculous and not flinching at the ridicule. What we must look out for in the record of Don Quixote is ridicule. The philosophy in the soul of my people presents itself to me as the expression of an inward tragedy analogous to the tragedy of the soul of Don Quixote, as the expression of a conflict between the world as the reason of science exhibits it to us and the world as we wish it to be, and as our religious faith tells us that it is. And in this philosophy is to be found the secret of what is usually said about us, that we are fundamentally irreducible to culture. That is to say, we don't resign ourselves to it, nor does Quixote resign himself to the world or its truth, nor to science or to logic or art or aesthetics or morality or ethics. I feel that I have a medieval soul, and I believe that the soul of my country is medieval, that it's been forced to traverse the Renaissance, the Reformation, and the Revolution, learning from them, yes, but without allowing them to touch the soul, preserving the spiritual heritage of those ages that are called dark. And Quixotism is nothing but the most desperate phase of the struggle of the Middle Ages against their offspring, the Renaissance. Did Don Quixote believe in the immediate and visible efficacy of his work? It is greatly to be doubted. At any rate, he didn't risk putting his visor to the test by giving it a second blow. Quixote journeyed alone with Sancho, alone with his solitude. And shall we not also journey alone, we his lovers, creating for ourselves a Quixotesque Spain which exists only in our imagination? And again will it be asked, what has Quixote bequeathed to culture? I answer, Quixotism, no little thing. A whole method, a whole epistemology, a whole aesthetic, a whole logic, a whole ethic, a whole religion, that is to say, a whole economy of things, human and divine, a whole hope in the rationally absurd. For what did Don Quixote fight? For Dulcinea, for glory, for life, for survival, not for Isolde, who is eternal flesh, nor for Beatrice, who is theology, not for Margaret, who is the people, not for Helen, who is culture. He fought for Dulcinea, and he won her, for he lives. And what is greatest in him is his having been ridiculed and overcome, for it is in being overcome that he overcame. He overcame the world by making it laugh at him. What then is the new mission of Quixote in the world today? To cry aloud in the wilderness. The wilderness hears, though men do not hear. And one day it will be transformed into a sounding forest, and this solitary voice that falls upon the wilderness like seed will yield a gigantic cedar, which with its 100,000 tongues will sing an eternal hosanna to the Lord of life and of death.
In the early 1950s, the nation recognized in its midst the social movement called the Beat Generation. A novel titled On the Road became a bestseller, and its author, Jack Kerouac, became a celebrity, partly because he'd written a powerful and successful book, partly because he seemed to be the embodiment of this new generation.
His behavior to me and to people around me, or when he was with me, was of a gentleness I found extraordinary, because I did not expect it. I did not expect it in view of the madness of the writing to be found in that book.
Well, he seemed to me to be completely apolitical. I don't think he ever signed a petition or took part in a demonstration.
I really think that he is a modern saint.
Salvador Dali, and I agree with him, said he was the most handsome man that he'd ever seen.
He had a compassionate, open understanding of those three alley cats and old ladies in the park. Empathy.
So here he is, Jack Kerouac. Jack told me a little earlier he was nervous. Are you nervous now? No? Good. Jack, I've got a couple of square questions, but I think the answer would be interesting. How long did it take you to write On the Road?
3 weeks.
How many?
3 weeks.
3 weeks? That's amazing. How long were you on the road itself?
7 years.
7 years. And I was on the road once for 3 weeks, and it took me 7 years to write about it. The other way around. I've heard that you write so fast that you don't like to use regular typing paper, but instead you prefer to use one big, long roll of paper. Is that true?
Yeah. When I write narrative novels, and I want to change my narrative thought, I keep going.
You don't want to change the pages at the end, you mean?
I put long teletype paper.
Oh, teletype rolls. Where do you get it?
Huh?
Where do you get the paper?
Teletype paper. For narrative, it's good.
Yeah, I got the most hard question of all, but everybody always puts it to you, I'm sure. And because everybody always puts it to you. How would you define the word beat? I don't mean why not time, I mean...
Sympathetic.
Up to the time he begins talking about people in the Times Square area, he follows a sort of Wolfian style, but it's when he begins to speak of people around Times Square that the true Jack comes out.
As far as I'm concerned, we were very moral. Hunky and I were talking about that today. He said it's amazing the way they think that we had these great big sex orgies. We never did. That's what bullshit. All we ever had, and the only thing we ever did was read books, and we sit around in a group and talk about them.
But the Angler Bar was sort of, became a convenient spot to hang out, because there was there were booths there, and then they also served food of a sort, and one could, you know, gather in there, and before long there'd be a whole crowd of people around one booth talking. Edie Parker, Kerouac's wife, his first wife, she would come down, Burroughs would come down and join the crowd, and of course Jack, a charmer, if there ever was one, without being aware of it, really. Alan, who was certainly a bright-eyed little boy in those days, sort of poetic appearing. Discussions of Rambo in Angler Bar were sort of funny, things like that, you know.
Well, when I first met him, I didn't know that he was a writer. When we became friendly, saw something of each other, he told me that he had already written a million words.
Jack and I used to sit around in my apartment in New York doing what a lot of young would-be writers in those days undoubtedly were doing also.
John Holmes.
Trying to see if we could discover what perhaps was unique about people of our age. And Jack said, well, it seems to me there is something that we are all, first he said, we're kind of furtive. I said, what do you mean? He said, we all walk down the street in the same way. And I knew what he meant without being able to describe it. And then he kept worrying the idea except, you know, we're really beat. It meant being reduced to the essentials. It came out of the war, when people had to live under a continual tension and stress, which was unnatural, and the only way to do it was to no longer engage in attitudinizing and poses. You were beat, and so any energy you had left to do what you had to do was the important thing to preserve, and all the crap went out of it.
We used to go down to the village a lot to see Lester Young and all the musicians. And one time Lester asked us to join him in a cab to go to Mittens, which was in Harlem. And that was the first time that Jack had ever smoked pot. And Lester Young was the one to give it to him. And we used to do this often. Seymour Wise was a friend of ours, and his brother ran Downbeat magazine. And we always knew where the musicians would play after ours, because that's when the musicians really played. So we would go to Harlem to hear him really blow.
Jazz for Jack became a living language. He was able,
Sam
by
Charter's
damn
talking.
Hard work, he really worked to make it happen, but he was able to get these rhythms into his prose by listening, by being open, and by hearing the jazz, which filled his life.
Began experimenting, myself, Burroughs, Kerouac, and Hunky and others, with benzedrine inhalers, and those were kind of interesting. I found within a year I couldn't hardly write on them because my mind got too tangled, but Jack found that he could write novels on them, and I think a few of his novels in the early 50s, and maybe some aspects of Town and the City, were written on amphetamine. Benzedrine inhaler, actually, and maybe Dexys. I think Jack's practice was to sit down and exhaust himself in a typewriter for several weeks at a time, living a very strict regimen, you know, writing continuously for, say, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, or maybe the whole day, sleeping it off, getting a big breakfast, starting it all over healthy the next day, and continuing.
Morning, Mr. Kerouac.
The benzedrine helped him to focus on his writing.
Sympathized dramatically with most of the people he knew and assigned them archetypal world stage roles. In a way of comparing people to characters in novels that were favored by everybody. So everybody came sort of like familiar with their alter egos as seen through Kerouac's eyes. So that he made it actually a mythology of his whole life and put people into the mythology, and it was a mythology that was so tender and dear and mortal that people knowingly fell into it with pleasure, because it was an interpretation that made sense. Actually, the portraits were caricatures even, but there was enough basic sympathy so that everybody got hooked in and charmed, and it's charmed everybody since.
Jack and I always find ourselves sitting on the sidelines, pots out of the kitchen, and would be banging away, and our terrific imagination of
Robert,
you know, drumming, and it was terrific. I, to this day, think of, you know, I still do it. And but we were shy of dancing, characteristically. In the meantime, Alan and Peter would be whirling by in, you know, delightful nudity or whatever, you dig it.
Alan brought Jack by to our house, and they came over with a matchbox of marijuana, and Jack was like slender, good-looking, dark movie star, and my sense of Jack was the artful self-consciousness that he felt in his body as he walked across the room, the way I used to feel when I walked across the high school cafeteria, so I could feel my cranium creak on the top of my spine with intensity of my self-perception of myself, imagining that all eyes were upon me. And Jack obviously felt that just walking from one side of our rather cozy apartment to the other when Joanne and Alan met over there.
He came to New York for the William Buckley Show. We were in Burroughs' room in a hotel. Jack was with a couple of Greek brothers-in-law, and he wanted Bill to come down. Bill said, "No, Jack, you're too drunk. I don't want to witness this outrage." So I went down with him. He took out a little tiny bottle in the dressing room and was tippling from that. I think he had a old 1920s F. Scott Fitzgerald hip flask at that point. And then got up on the Buckley program with that same heavy, solid, redneck, beer belly look.
Now, Jack, Mr. Kerouac, what I want to ask is this. To what extent do you believe that the Beat Generation is related to the hippies?
Oh, that's what the hippies are good kids. They're better than the Beat. The Beats, see, Ginsberg at the hand. Wow, Ginsberg, boy. We're all in our 40s, mm-hmm. and we started this, and the kids took it up and everything. But a lot of hoodlums and communists jumped on our backs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on my back, not his.
Mm-hmm.
Ferlinghetti jumped on my back and turned the idea that I had that the B generation was a generation of beatitude and pleasure in life and tenderness. But they called it, in the papers, a beat mutiny, beat insurrection, words I never used.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Catholic.
Jack was not a particularly sloppy drunk. His voice was rarely thick with alcohol, but his mind became inflamed, and he became more and more of a monologist. He was not any longer interested in dialogue.
More involved with the idea of suffering, as he'd always been, but in a Catholic, Christian and Catholic vision of Sacred Heart, Wounded Heart. Made a lot of paintings of Christ suffering, of Mary suffering, and saw his own existence as suffering, to a point where he wondered why it was worth being born. When Gregory had a baby, he said, oh, you're just bringing up a thing to die. It's a cruel remark, very tender, but on the other hand, springing from a frank understanding that birth means death.
So he lived a very hermit-like life.
Jack Kerouac, the novelist who wrote On the Road, reached the end of it today. The 47-year-old spokesman for the Beat Generation died of a massive hemorrhage in the St. Petersburg, Florida hospital. Kerouac's books, selling millions of copies, translated into 18 languages, were regarded as a bridge between older bohemian movements and today's hippies.
I don't know of any other writer who had more seminal influence than Kerouac in opening up the heart of the writer to tell the truth from his own secret personal mind.
I think he's a direct descendant of Whitman and Thomas Rowe. You know, the American bardic tradition.
I think that On the Road, which in my judgment is his masterpiece, stands up there with Huckleberry Finn and Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick.
Out of his road, side roads go into new journalism, into personal narrative fiction, into a kind of prose which is neither fiction nor nonfiction, but is actually the mind of the writer thinking about the real world.
A lot of people have asked me why did I write that book or any book. All the stories I wrote were true, because I believed in what I saw. I was traveling west one time, at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, a great image of God, with forefinger pointed straight at me, through halos and rolls and gold folds that were like the existence of the gleaming spear in his right hand, which saith, come on, boy, go down across the ground. Go moan for man. Go moan. Go groan. Go groan alone. Go roll your bones alone. Go down and be little beneath my sight. Go down and be minutest seed in the pod. Go thou, die hence. And of this world report you well and truly. Anyway, I wrote the book because we're all going to die. In the loneliness of my life, my father dead, my brother dead, my mother far away, my sister and my wife far away. Nothing here but my own tragic hands that once were guarded by a world, a sweet attention, a that now are left to guide and disappear their own way into the common dark of all our death? Sleeping in the raw bed alone and stupid, with just this one pride and consolation? My heart broke in a general despair. It opened up inwards to the Lord. I made a supplication in this dream. So in the last page of On the Road, I describe how the hero, Dean Moriarty, has come to see me all the way from the West Coast just for a day or two. We've just been back and forth across the country several times in cars, and now our adventures are over. We're still great friends, but we have to go into later phases of our lives. So there he goes, Dean Moriarty, ragged in the moth-eaten overcoat he brought specially for the freezing temperatures of the East, walking off alone, and last I saw him, he rounded the corner of 7th Avenue, eyes on the street ahead, and bent to it again. Gone. So, in America, when the sun goes down, then I sit on the old broken down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over the West Coast, and all that road going, and all the people dreaming in the immensity of it. And now I know by now that children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. And tonight the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all the rivers, cups the peaks, folds the final shore in. Nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Think of Dean Moriarty, or even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. Think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.
All the pictures used to motivate from Transylvania, and Boris Karloff narrates them. Oh, Bela, Bela, do you realize we haven't had a gig in 6 months? I don't know what it is, but we could walk the Vegas, the loungers, better than the goofers, you know? I don't know what's coming of the industry, but soon the train will break down, and Bela will be walking up looking for lodgings for the night. And we hear the knock on the door and the woman answering.
Mm-hmm. Who are you? I've never seen you before. You're a stranger in Transylvania. What is your name? Who are you?
Permit me to come through, my dear. My name is Count Dracula.
Oh, you sound pretty wild. Come in. This town is the squarest. No one's come through here. That's been far out for years.
Myself, my family are looking for lodgings for the night. And we don't want to be disturbed. Here's 10 years' rent in advance. Leave me alone. That's all. We want the room. Call it. Split. All right. Now I will take my family out of the boxes.
Papa, it's so good to be out of the box. Papa.
Shut up and drink your blood. Bite Mama good night.
I can't stand to look at you. You.
But I don't bug me.
Don't give me, bug me with all the hip talk. Don't be bimbopper, you.
Get off my back. I'm being the trip, the bus. We lost the arrangements, everything. Now, leave me alone, will you? One time, leave me alone.
Sure, look at you. Supposed to be fancy then, handsome, with the Vaseline on the hair. Dirting up all the pillowcases. I can't stand to look at you, pimp you. Ech. You're so long.
All right. I'm trying to bring home a little bread. All you want from me, all right, so I don't play jazz. I'm not a swinger. I'm trying. I'm not a bebop, but what do you want from me? I know I've got it. Music business keeps changing, that's what it is. Sure. That Russ Morgan took all my key men. That's what it is. You can only get a good rhythm section. It is getting light out. I'm getting weak. Excuse me, madam.
Well, God has another reason, too. Remember later how your mother told you about the different openings in your body and what they were for?
Yes, I...
Not against Vietnam. They demonstrated against the police department. Actually, against policemen. Because they had that concept of the law, that the law and the law enforcement are one. And it started, said, well, we have to have some rules. That's how the law starts, out of the fact. Let's see. I tell you what we'll do. We'll have a vote. We'll sleep in Area A. Is that cool? Okay, good. We'll eat in Area B. Good? Good. We'll throw our crap in Area C. So everything went on pretty cool, you know, everybody's very happy. One night, everybody's sleeping, guy woke up, pow, got a face full of crap. And said, hey, what's the deal here? I thought we had a rule. He said, eat, sleep, and crap, and I was sleeping, and I got a face full of crap. So he said, well, the rule was substantive. That's what the 14th Amendment is. It regulates the rights, but it doesn't do anything about it. It just says that's where it's at. We'll have to do something to enforce the provisions, to give us some teeth. Here's the deal. If anybody throws any crap on us while we're sleeping, they get thrown in the crap house. Agreed? Because, well, everybody? Yeah, but what about if it's my mother? You don't understand. You might as well be the fact. That has nothing to do with it. It's just a rule. Eat, sleep, and crap. Anybody throws any crap on us, they get thrown right in the crap house. Your mother doesn't enter into it. Everybody's mother gets thrown in the crap house. Priests, rabbis, they all go. Agreed? Okay, agreed. Okay, now going along very cool. Huh? Guy's sleeping. Pow! Into the face full of crap. Now he wakes up. He sees he's all alone, this guy. And he looks, and everybody's having a big party. He says, hey, what's the deal? I thought we had a rule, eat, sleep, and crap, and you just threw a face full of crap on me. They said, oh, it's a religious holiday. And we told you many times that you're going to live your indecent life and sleep all day. You deserve to be throwing crap on you while you're sleeping. If you want to sleep all day, and the guy said, bullshit. The rule's the rule, and this guy started to separate the church and the state right down the middle. Pow! Here's a church rule, and here's a federalist rule. Okay, everything's going on very cool. That guy said, hey, wait a minute. Although we made the rule, and how are we going to get somebody to throw somebody in the crap house? We need somebody to enforce it. Law enforcement, okay. Now they put the sign up in the wall, and you wanted law enforcement. The guys apply for the job. Look, here's our problem. See, we're trying to get some sleep, and people keep throwing crap on us. Now, we want somebody to throw them right in a crap house. And I'm delegated to do the hiring here. And so here's what the job is. You see, they won't go in the crap house by themselves. And we all agreed on the rule now. And we firmed it up, so there's nobody gets out of it. Everybody's vulnerable. They go throw right in the crap house. But you see, I can't do it because I do business with these assholes. And it looks bad for me, you know. So I want somebody to do it for me, you know. So I tell you what, here's a stick and a gun, and you do it. But wait till I'm out of the room. And whenever it happens, see, I'll wait back here and I'll watch, you know. And you make sure you kick him in the ass and throw him in there. Now, you'll hear me say a lot of times that it takes a certain kind of mentality to do that work, you know, and all that bullshit, you know, but you understand it's all horseshit, and you just kick him in the ass and make sure it's done. So it happens that
Now comes the riot, or the marches. Everybody's wailing and blah, 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 blah. Now you got a cop there who's standing with a short sleeve shirt on and a stick in his hand. And a people yelling, Gestapo at him. Gestapo, you asshole, and the mailman.
Well, with all these changes you can see, getting taller and your breasts beginning to grow and...
Oh, no, Bob. Well, what I'm talking about now is the fluid that contains the sperm or the seed. It's formed in two little sacs beneath the penis, which we call the testicles. But wet dreams, as we call them, are very different. You see, the body manufactures that fluid all the time.
Gee, our bodies are complicated, aren't they, Dad?
Well, you bet.
There's particularly three points in this recording. First, the unabashed normal use of such technical terms as penis and sperm. These flatter a boy's sense of responsibility.
Thank you, boy. Do like that in our gang. Used to tell jokes, could not tell jokes for shit. Clifford used to tell good jokes, you know. But Bubba was a nigga that could not tell a joke. Right? You know them kind of niggas just can't tell a joke, but you have to laugh anyway, you know. Nigga will hurt you. You know? Like Clifford tell this little joke and shit, you know. Yeah, so there it is, man. The dude was in school. Little Johnny joke. Then check this out. Little Johnny in school, and teacher asked question, say, what's the most interesting thing that ever happened, you know? And was a young lady in herself, Mary said, my mother and father went on vacation all alone. That was cool, you know. Check that, huh? So they come, little Johnny, and teacher say, little Johnny, what's thing happened to you, you know? So little Johnny say, well, my brother was in Vietnam, got shot in the ass. The teacher say, hey, freeze. You know, don't say ass, say rectum, you know. You know, little Johnny say, rectum shit, it killed him. Yeah. Yeah, and Bubba, hey, wait, I got one. I got one. Check this out. There's a dude, two holes, right? Check this out. Dude went in the whole house and his dick was out, right? And he go, no, wait, that's not it. Wait, here's it. Dick. No, dick. The dude go into the hole. No, there's two nuns. Check this out. Check this, bro. Two nuns was going down the street and the nun had a dick, right? So the dude... No, the two dudes, there it is, the two dudes. Two dudes dressed like nuns, right? And they go in the whole house and the dicks came out. Ha ha! That's a funny motherfucker, ain't it, bro? There you go. Ha, yeah, bro, that's funny shit, yeah. Whoo, shit, that's so funny.
Every time you'd ordinarily pause in speaking or say like. Remember, any declarative sentence can begin with the word like and end with the word man. I am going to the post office becomes hip by saying, like I'm going to the post office, man, or man, like I'm going to the post office, or even man, I'm going to the post office, like. You dig? Then add dig and I'm hip. Like, man, dig, and I'm hip are the key to basic spoken hip. And the imaginative student might well be able to pass himself off as a hipster with only these four expressions.
Oh, true. Sad, but true.
Unfortunately, we can...
You know how black humor started? It started in slave ships, you know. Cat was on his way away rowing. You know, too sick. What are you laughing about? That yesterday I was a king. And having a bicentennial 200 years. Gonna have a bicentennial, nigga. They will. They have some nigga 200 years old in blackface with stars and stripes on his forehead. Eyes, lips just shining. And he'll have that lovely white folks expression on his face. But he's happy. He's happy because he's been here 200 years. Said, I'm just so thrilled to be here. Over here in America. I'm so glad y'all took me out of die, homie. I used to live to be 150. Now I die of high blood pressure by the time I'm 52. And that thrills me to death. I'm just so pleased America's gonna last. They brought me over here in a boat. There was 400 of us come over here.
360 of us died on the way over here. I love that. That just thrilled me so. I don't know, you white folks are just so good to us. Got over here, another 20 of us died from disease. But you didn't have no doctors to take care of us. I'm so sorry you didn't. Upset you all some too, didn't it? Then they split us all up. Yes, sir, we took my mom over that way, took my wife that way, took my kids over yonder. I'm just so happy. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do if I don't get 200 more years of this. Lord of mercy. Yes, sir, I don't know where my old mama is now. She up yonder in that big white folks in the sky. Y'all probably done forgot about it. But I ain't gonna never forget it.
It's a very important. You fall out in your pad. Now, it's very uncool to fall out in somebody else's pad, man. You can nod in somebody else's pad. Nod, that's like a very hip nap. Yeah, you can nod there, you know, if it's a cool friend and if you're tight with them. But you don't want cats to fall out on you, because sometimes they're there for days and you scream split and they don't even hear you. You have to keep stepping over them, and they hang up the bathroom and it's a stone drag. Believe me, it can be very dangerous to fall out someplace where you don't know the cats too well. A very freaked out chick. If she grooves and if she's got something happening for her, you say that chick is insane. What you mean is like she's a, what do you call it? You know, a good person. Would you say the hipster's preoccupation with insanity would indicate a rejection, or at least a deep questioning, of the traditional separation of normal and abnormal, sanity and insanity? In other words, a deliberate reassessment and reevaluation of the bourgeois standards of morality and... No. I wouldn't say that. No, I would never say that, man. Dig. Say you're talking about this cat. Say he's a musician, and he really makes it, you dig? I mean, he's into something. He's free, and he swings. Then you say, that cat has got a loose wig. Because it's very important to work on your brains. Smash your brains, you know, crack them. Yeah? That's when it could start happening for you. I see. St. Teresa once used the phrase, breaking the mind's barrier. Indeed she did, and that's very hip. St. Teresa swings, so does St. John of the Cross. I mean, you know, the Spanish one. But dig. You see all these cats running around desperately afraid they're going to flip, you know? And they're running around holding themselves together with scotch tape and chicken wire and 18 martinis for lunch. Juice heads are the lowest, man. And they're all afraid they're going to crack and explode all over their friends. And it'll be very messy and embarrassing. And they're going to blow their gig at the agency. And the finance company is going to come and repossess the children. And it's going to be the end of the world, you know. Much hipper just to relax and flip. You know, groove with it. You know, you begin to go, you know, and you spew the immortal, the ever word pudding. You know, you could shoot the scenery, you can run around, you could wail upon yourself, dragging yourself round and round and about inside your own head. You never move, you sit there quiet, your face in a complete smiling groove, and internally you're on the loose wig. Yes, it's a.
And now, ladies and gentlemen. The world-famous latter on this sofa occasion to say goodbye to the dearly departed. He was dearly and he has departed. Thus, that's why we call him the dearly departed. In other words, the nigga dead. As you can see him laying here, I've been here 3 days, the boy ain't moved a muscle. So I know the nigga dead. And it seemed that death was quite a surprise to his ass. Didn't think you was ever gonna die, did you, nigga? I told you about fucking around what was gonna happen. However, he faced the ultimate test, as each man and woman must eventually face the ultimate test. And the ultimate test is Let me repeat that. The ultimate test is whether or not you can survive death. That's the ultimate test for your ass, ain't it? So far, don't nobody we know have passed the ultimate test. Least of all, this nigga laying here. Because this boy wasn't shit, I'm going to tell you that right off. I saw him kicking his mama's ass over there on 47th Street. And if you think we gonna bury you with them diamonds and shit on, you got another thing coming. I'd like to introduce the boy's woman, whole bitch, I don't know what she was, huh? She's laying over there in the booth. What? Say, girl, what you doing? Well, don't sell no pussy in here. If you do, I want a cut. Shit. Your fault, the nigga dead. You'd have been home when you were supposed to be. He wouldn't have been up in the hotel fucking that faggot.